Case number 09-5126, Michael Arthur Newdow et al., appellants versus John G. Roberts, Jr., Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court et al. Mr. Newdow for the appellants, Mr. Sturgill for appellees John G. Roberts et al., Mr. Perella for appellee Presidential Inaugural Committee.
Good morning, I'm Mike Newdow, counsel for the appellants. May it please the court. This case is about what has been termed the transcendent ritual of America's democracy and representative government. For more than 140 years, the government abided by that principle that has been argued by the Supreme Court, ruled by the Supreme Court in cases such as McCurry County and in the Employment Division v. Smith, where they stated that what you have to do, the government may not lend its power to one or the other side in controversies over religious dogma. And since the 1930s, the government has lent its power to one side of the controversy, perhaps the greatest controversy in terms of religious dogma, whether or not God exists. It's done this in two ways. First of all, the Chief Justice of the United States has done something that's rather extraordinary. This is the personification of the rule of law. This is the embodiment of the idea that we have a Constitution with text, which is altered only by the means that are placed in the Constitution. And he's altered the text with no authority.
I agree with that proposition, but we've lost on that.
Well, okay. well, he's done that. And also we have the chaplains being brought into the inaugural ceremony and espousing the glory of God, and they're not allowed to do that. They're taking this position that God exists, and we challenge that. This case isn't about the merits right now. Today we're only discussing standing. And we obviously, the plaintiffs, believe that the merits are in our favor, that the Establishment Clause is violated. And I just want to make sure the court recognizes, as I'm sure you do, that you have to today also agree that the merits have been violated. Under Warth v. Selden and this court a year ago in Emergency Coalition to Defend Educational Travel, you stated that when considering the merits, we must assume when considering standing, we must assume the merits in favor of the party seeking our jurisdiction. And so you have to assume that when the Supreme Court says things like the religious liberty protected by the Constitution is abridged when the state affirmatively sponsors the particular religious practice of prayer, when you take two chaplains and you stick them up on the dais during the inauguration, you are violating that principle.
What if they weren't chaplains?
Well, I think that would be the same thing if they were put in place by the government.
So it has nothing to do with their being chaplains.
Well, I think the fact that they're chaplains certainly exacerbates that issue. It says, look, we're taking men of the cloth.
You're not sufficiently accommodated if only chaplains are barred, correct?
Excuse me?
If only chaplains are barred from administering the oath, from invoking God at the ceremony, you would still be aggrieved, would you not, by the presence of some layperson doing that?
Right. I think if anybody came up...
So we can put chaplains out of the equation here of what we're talking about.
I think it's certainly worse with chaplains. Chaplains are there, too. I mean, that's their role in life. That's why they're picked up. Somebody else could, you know, sneak it by and say, well, I'm not really here for speaking about God, whereas chaplains, I think, undoubtedly are there to talk about God and to pray to God and to lead in prayer to God, which is even worse.
Why isn't the challenge regarding 2009, pardon me, behind us and moot?
Well, it would be, except that we, in our prayer for relief, we suggested that we want relief for the future. And also, we have an amended complaint, which I think the district court...
So it would be except for your prayer for the future?
In the original complaint, there's a prayer for relief that says we want to make sure this doesn't happen in the future as well.
So we can forget about 2009 and focus on the future.
Right. I think 2009 is moot. I don't know.
Okay. Well, that slims things down a little bit.
As to 2013, is there a declaration that says that the plaintiffs will attend in person?
I don't know if any of the declarations specified that. But I would point out that in the Martin Medhurst article that was placed into the record by the defendants, They specifically said, I think it's on page 47 of the appendix, Martin Medhurst says that whereas the chaplain's prayer was originally directed only to the senators, it since became directed toward everybody attending, including those who listened and viewed via the media. So I don't think that the media actually makes much difference. If you're watching this, it's being broadcast by the government so that everybody can see it through the media as well.
Mr. Nuno, looking at 2013 now, you say in your brief, this is at 38, the distinction between if the president-elect utters those words and you are there and hear them as compared to the Chief Justice of the United States is huge. Those who observe someone individually adding, so help me God, to an oath he is taking, the president-elect, especially after the oath administrator first recited the oath without those words, immediately recognized that the addendum reflects nothing but the oath taker's personal religious belief. That's not what happens, of course. And you say, when the administrator, however, has first included that phrase as a component of the text, and it's then repeated, the obvious message is that homage to God is part and parcel of the state's official religious orthodoxy. But you know it's not, right?
I know it's not. That's correct.
So how is it an injury to you?
Well, I think, first of all, you have the stigmatic injury, which
But you just said the message is that it's part of the state's religious orthodoxy.
Message to me, because I know that. But the people standing next to me and all around me think, oh, yeah, that's right. We are a nation.
All right. So then, and how does that affect you?
It continues the stigmatic injury. Personally affects me. I'm right there. And in Allen v. Wright, the Supreme Court stated.
They're being misled or get a misimpression.
Correct.
And the misimpression then is transmitted to an effect on you?
Yes, I think there's a stigma. I mean, that's the whole essence of a stigmatic injury when the Supreme Court spoke about that. It said this sort of non-economic injury.
Well, there's a stigma when a child has to leave the room every time there's a religious exercise, so the religious exercise goes out of the classroom rather than the child.
Okay.
How does that translate to you?
I think there's a stigma when you are an atheist in this nation and the government keeps saying real Americans believe in God. And here we are reinforcing that one more time. There's tons of data which, if we ever get to court, we can present, which show that atheists are second-class citizens in this nation. And I think it strongly is related to the fact that the government continually reinforces the idea that you are second-class citizens. We are a nation that believes in God. I have people all the time who bring
it's a little different than what I took your original complaint to say, which was that you were wounded directly when you have to sit through hearing this.
Well, I am wounded directly because the...
Well, this says in 38, you're saying it's quite indirect. Other people are misled, and then they stigmatize you.
I think there's both. I think, first of all, you have the stigmatic injury, and then you have the government saying, again, that God exists. I know that that's not part, that when the president's doing it, that it isn't like as is explained there on that page. I know that for a fact, but I still am getting the government saying that God exists. That is a direct injury to me. That's the exact same direct injury if you have the chaplains praying to God. I know that the chaplains shouldn't be there. I know what the Constitution says, but the government, in the meantime, is using these chaplains as it uses the Chief Justice to say that God exists.
The government in this instance being
the Chief Justice of the United States.
Even though he's simply carrying out the preference of the president-elect.
He may have that in his mind, but he is still telling everybody and me that the government of the United States thinks this is a fine thing, that you should believe in God.
To follow up on that, you've acknowledged that the president-elect could add those words on his or her own. So if the president-elect says to the Chief Justice, I would like you to include that in the oath because I want to say it, why isn't that okay?
Because the same reason that the president-elect couldn't say, hey, I want to have any other discriminatory practice going on. He couldn't say, I want that the protesters out on the lawn to be carried away here. I mean, that may be what he wants to do, but he's not allowed to do that. Granted, it's a little different when you actually remove protesters, but he's still sending that message. And he's allowed to send that message on his own. He's not allowed to get the government to do that. He couldn't say, let's have... there's so many different things. I always make the reference to race. Right? He couldn't say, we think that whites are better than blacks. Right? He can believe that. He's entitled to have that belief, but he's not allowed to get the government to abide.
Well, he makes a speech and he says all kinds of things.
That's right, and he's entitled because he has free speech rights and he has free exercise rights, but he doesn't have the right to get the rest of the government to do that same sort of...
And the rest of the government here is just the Chief Justice?
In that one instance, correct, or in the rest of the inauguration, bringing the chaplains on board to say that God exists.
What do you do with the fact that the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, I guess most recently in Justice Breyer's controlling opinion in Van Orden, that ceremonial deism statements, references to God, in God we trust, under God, so help me God, are consistent with the Establishment Clause?
Well, I think that that's quite debatable, and that's a merits issue. But today we're just up to here for standing. And if, in fact...
Well, we can affirm on alternative grounds.
We certainly can, but then we have a whole bunch of other statements from the Supreme Court. For instance, you know, the touchstone for our Establishment Clause jurisprudence is the need for neutrality. The First Amendment mandates government neutrality between religion and religion.
Well, I think I understand that, but still, in application, the Court has said, and again, Justice Breyer's opinion in Van Orden specifically said that these kinds of references to God in various ceremonial circumstances, which you're, of course, familiar with, are permissible.
Well, he said it in that one case of Van Orden, which had one statue among 38 others. It was quite a different thing. Here, there's nothing else. All we have are chaplains with prayers to God. I'm running out of time, I want to save for rebuttal, but if I might just review quickly.
Could you just repeat? We'll give you extra time. Could you just repeat what you said to Judge Kavanaugh by way of distinguishing Van Orden?
Van Orden was one monument among 38 separate monuments out on the dais.
About the mall?
On the mall, correct.
I mean, that's what we've got here, the National Mall.
But we don't have any other non-governmental speakers coming up. We don't have the Chief Justice saying anything else, adding anything else, changing the oath of office in the Constitution in any other way except to say, so help me God. He doesn't say, so help me God, and we have the Alamo, and we have all these other things. He only says one thing. That's the huge difference. That was the difference between McCreary County and Van Orden. Van Orden said, we have all this stuff. We don't want hostility toward religion. We don't want to single out religion as one thing among many and say, no, you can't have religion.
Well, the other things in Van Orden are historical markers, for instance, right?
Right.
And the scene at the inauguration is replete with things like that.
But not on the dais. No, the Chief Justice does not take the oath of office and add anything to that oath of office except, so help me God. That's the only thing. It isn't like...
Why should we narrow the focus to that rather than the whole experience, as in Van Orden?
Because Van Orden was, I suppose you could say, that one monument. You could do that, but that would be, I think...
The Court didn't, so that tells us that the focus is something... Or maybe something broader than
that. You can do that with every case. I mean, we could take the graduation at Lee versus.
Well,
Winston.
But the companion case to Van Orden, which concerned the Ten Commandments at a courthouse, the Court said you couldn't do that. You had to look at it in the context of its being a courthouse, right? Just as you had in the other case to look at it in the context of the park in Austin, and in a courthouse, that was communicating a message to potential litigants that they might have a problem if they're not believers.
But again, the courthouse, are we talking about McCreary County right now?
Is that the companion?
Yes,
case?
That's McCreary County. Yeah. So in McCreary County, we know, I mean, they had, as a matter of fact, they put in all the additional things so that it looked like it was one of many, but that was a purpose case. The Supreme Court said, well, what are you doing with this one part where you put in the Ten Commandments? And the history showed that that was how it originated, as just the Ten Commandments.
Well, I thought one of the distinctions between Van Orden and McCreary County was the fact of how long it had been there, right? Traditional, and this blends in, I guess, to Marsh v. Chambers and really Justice Breyer's opinion in Van Orden, the idea that traditional references to God or traditional ceremonial references will be considered permissible.
And if you do take that argument, we have to look again at Marsh v. Chambers, says that goes all the way back to the beginning.
Okay, well, so help me God, and I take your point on the presidential oath, but certainly it was in the Judiciary Act of 1789 as to other oaths.
Correct. It was. So, but
am I correct in understanding that you think we should confine ourselves to the standing issue at this stage?
I think so. Yes.
You want to go back to district court on the merits?
Absolutely. So we can bring some evidence in and show what was the purpose, what was going on in terms of this entire process. And if we do look at standing, there's two ways to go about looking at standing. One is you do as the Supreme Court said in Allen v. Wright. You look at other cases. You have, after our opening brief, you have listings of cases. You have the first listing has six United States Supreme Court cases where they were in the exact same position. As you said, Judge Kavanaugh, in the Navy chaplaincy case, the government was engaging in religious speech that the plaintiffs had to either observe or hear. We had the exact same situation in all of those cases.
In the chaplain's case, though, it didn't avail the plaintiffs.
That's correct, but the distinction was made by Judge Kavanaugh that said, here's what we have in this case. This is different from those prayer and display cases.
Van Orden and the like, right. So, I mean, Van Orden is a good case for you on standing, obviously.
Correct. All of those cases, right? You have six cases with the Supreme Court in the prayer cases. You have five Supreme Court cases in the display cases, and you have every circuit.
Well, I know the point you've made about taking those cases into account, but I think we're pretty clearly on record, and I think the Supreme Court is too, that if they didn't discuss standing, we don't take it as a precedent.
Actually, I have some problem with that. Right?
You made an interesting point about it, but I think we're stuck with what the Supreme Court has said on it.
Well, the Supreme Court said, though, in FWPBS, that we are required to do this. The only reason they didn't raise it in those cases is because it's so obvious that they have standing. I looked actually just
well, we don't just know if it was overlooked or if it was obvious or if there's something in the record that made it obvious that's not in the opinion.
when they tell us that it is the obligation of the courts to make sure that standing exists.
Sometimes Homer nods.
No, but what you're saying is that in 11 cases.
Repeatedly.
Well, maybe. I looked up your cases. I did a search just this morning on Kavanaugh, Ginsburg, and Brown on your cases in the last 5 years. And it looks like I think there were 254 cases that you have decided. And in those cases.
As a group?
No, not as a group, but individual. Okay. And I think 74 mentioned the word standing, and about 30% of those are things like, Judge Brown, you used longstanding often. So stuff like that.
So upstanding.
But upstanding, right? Any kind of standing. So I think, in fact, only, you know, you yourselves, only about 20% of the time, it looks like something in that order, actually address standing. That doesn't mean that you didn't do your job on those 80 other percent.
Well, let me give you a since you've used all your time, I'll use some of mine. Okay. We had an en banc case some 20 years ago in which the panel suggested that it was bound by a precedent that it thought should be revisited. The losing party sought rehearing. The court granted it. And at the rehearing en banc, counsel for the petitioner said something that caused Judge Bork, who had been the author of the panel opinion suggesting we should revisit this question, to ask a follow-up question and thereby reveal that the petitioner didn't have standing from the outset. Sometimes it doesn't come out right away or ever.
And that may be the case, but I think that the overwhelming amount of case law that we have with all of these people having standing, I think that would be very unlikely. Then the other method of a determining standing would be the method in Lujan, whether or not there's an injury in fact, whether or not there's causation, whether or not there's redressability. I think those things are very simple. I'll leave my time now and hopefully get it in rebuttal, and I'll see what the
other side says. Let me hold you back just a moment, see if I have anything else. Yes, Valley Forge.
Yes.
You said the Supreme Court's choice of words was unfortunate, and it is for the point of view of your cause, but we have to deal with it. And I'm not sure how you're suggesting we do so other than deem it unfortunate.
Well, I think that, first of all, the Supreme Court remedied that to whatever degree it was flawed to begin with in Lujan when Justice Scalia specifically said the right to observe a species being injured is unquestionably a basis for standing. And Judge Kavanaugh, you used the same thing, too, in the Navy chaplaincy case. You said when the government is engaging in speech, that is observed by the plaintiffs. I think if we read Valley Forge and you look at that quotation in the context, he's talking about observation. Chief Justice Rehnquist is talking about observation of the fact that the government has violated the law. If you were just observing that, you know, as in that case, they got a newspaper report that says, look what happened. They said, oh, yeah, we're standing back. It's kind of like the concerned bystander that they had in Heckler v. Matthews.
So it's sort of like the old tort doctrine of going to the nuisance.
To some degree. I think basically.
Why aren't you going to the nuisance?
I
well, you go to the inauguration and then complain about it.
Oh, well, no, I don't think it's like that at all. I'm not going to the inauguration to have this. I'm going to the inauguration to do what hundreds of millions of other people did, to watch the President of the United States, especially this historic occasion, get inaugurated. I have every right to do that. And I don't
of course you have every right. They had every right to read the newspaper and, or go to Pennsylvania, but the point was it attenuated their claim to injury.
I think the way to look at it is, are you getting confronted with Establishment Clause violations because you're going after them? There's the case, which I can't remember the name of right now, where there was a parent who was going through the internet, I think I mentioned it in the brief, and was looking for a look at what the government did, and she said, look, I was on the internet. And they said, that doesn't give you standing. You were going after that. When I didn't go to the inauguration. The plaintiffs here didn't go to the inauguration to be insulted. We went to the inauguration to watch the president view the inauguration, take his oath. And that's very different. And what happened in Valley Forge, they weren't doing anything. They found out about this as an aside. Somebody said,
you know,
look.
Your affidavit somewhat, I thought, suggested that you've gone to inaugurations and are making a point of doing things because of your interest in this oath.
No, because of my, well, partially an interest of the oath, but partially to see the inauguration of the president. And that's certainly, that would be me uniquely among all the other plaintiffs. We certainly have a number of plaintiffs who went like millions of other Americans. Most Americans don't go to the inauguration to see the president say, so help me God. They go to see the oath of office being taken.
But again, what the president says is not the gravamen of your case.
Right, right. He has
only
free exercise rights.
The Chief Justice or whomever administers the oath.
Correct.
Okay. Further questions?
You have not really addressed redressability, and
okay.
That seems one of the more difficult issues. Hmm.
I hope not. I think that basically there are two main cases that I would refer to, the Clinton v. City of New York and Franklin v. Massachusetts. And I'll note, by the way, in Franklin v. Massachusetts, in regard to addressability, the term in Lujan, which was also a 1992 case, they spoke specifically about redressability being just likely as opposed to speculative. And then 2 weeks later in Franklin v. Massachusetts, they come up and they said specifically that they used the term again, likely. They said, we may assume that it is substantially likely that the president and the other executive branch officers and the other congressional branch officers will abide by an authoritative interpretation of the congressional provision by the district court, even though they are not bound to. We assume it's likely, and that's exactly was the term that they used in Lujan. So we don't need an absolute. We don't need to know for sure that the president or the presidential inaugural committee or the chief justice will do this. All we need to show is that it's likely, and that's what courts do. That's the whole basis of judicial review. It is likely that the other branches of government will abide by what the federal courts say.
But here we're only dealing with the president. The inauguration really belongs
no,
to him.
I would disagree with that. What we're dealing with is the president's subordinates, as Justice Scalia specifically stated in his concurrence in Franklin v. Massachusetts. He said, in terms of redressability, he says, of course, he says, there is, how does he put it, nothing in any way suggests that the president's actions are unreviewable. The review of the legality of the president's actions can ordinarily be obtained in a suit seeking to enjoin the officers who attempt to enforce the president's directive. That's exactly what we have here. Here we have the Presidential Inaugural Committee, the Chief Justice, who are attempting to enforce the president's directive that says violate the Establishment Clause, well, and no, normally what we do is we have a suit against those individuals.
That went a little too fast for me. Who to whom would the relief run? Who would be the recipient of this injunction or more likely declaration?
To whom is it addressed? Defendants?
Yes, yes.
All of the defendants we have named.
The Chief Justice most relevantly here.
Okay.
All right. So the president-elect in the wake of that says, well, Chief Justice is constrained by this decree, so I'm not going to have him administer the oath. I'll have someone else do it. And then, because I want them to include the reference to God. Doesn't that frustrate the decree?
Well, but the president could do the same thing with Franklin v. Massachusetts. He could appoint somebody else to give him whatever in terms of, I think it was in the census. In every case, couldn't the president always tell his subordinates, or if the subordinate is bound, say, I want another subordinate?
Well, no, not if they're part of the government.
Sorry?
He might not be able to do that if the rationale for restraining him is that the government can't do this. Okay?
Okay.
But if the answer is, okay, well, then I'll go outside the government, then it avoids the decree.
But I don't see how he can go outside the government. They can't get onto the dais to, if you want to do the oath part, How is somebody going to get onto the dais? They have to go through the presidential.
His family is on the dais.
And they got there because...
Lots of people are on the dais, and he says to one of them, I'm going to ask you to administer the oath this year.
Well, I suppose the president of the United States can sneak around a decree of the federal judiciary, but I don't think he would do that. I hope he wouldn't. And I think, again, we go back to the substantially likely. It is substantially likely that the president is exactly what they said in Franklin v. Massachusetts, and the other executive branch officers and the congressional officials will abide by a decision by the district court. And that was a district court.
Let me make, I think this is implicit in what you've said so far. You have said 2009 is moot. That's out of here. We're looking at 2013. We're looking at the Chief Justice.
Right.
I think it's a fact, but I think my question is whether it matters to you, whether if it's a fact, that the other defendants no longer exist.
Correct.
They do not exist.
And this circuit, a year ago, in Centers for Arms Control and Nonproliferation v. Prey, spoke of that, and they said that what you could do is you can get a declaration of the plaintiff's rights, which could be used against other plaintiffs, against other defendants in an injunction, and therefore redress the plaintiff's claimed injury. It's specifically
but for the present litigation, the redress would run to the Chief Justice, and if somebody else, if a new presidential inaugural committee is created for 2013, you could then try to apply it to them. But for now, it's just the Chief Justice that is, remains in the case.
Only if you say that our amended complaint does not exist.
They say and you agree they've gone out of existence.
As did the commission from the Congressional Commission in the Senate.
And therefore, the relief would run against the Chief Justice. And could perhaps be applied to some later committees that are created.
Correct. Would be applied to some.
But the present relief would run just against the Chief Justice.
I think the court has the ability to say, as a declaratory judgment, this applies to any presidential inaugural committee. Those certain, otherwise, you have the situation of capable of repetition and avoiding review. I mean, they always, every 4 years, by the time you bring the case, they're gone out of business. You'd never
well, except that the Chief Justice doesn't go out of business.
Yes, correct. I mean, although there may be a different Chief Justice, although he's in his official capacity as well.
Well, even if he's not, he's a young, healthy man.
That's true. Hopefully.
I mean, a mortality table would tell us that he's overwhelmingly likely to be there.
Correct. Although, according to the defendants, that's not absolute, and so they seem
well,
to...
Well, anything can happen.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Newberg.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Lowell Sturgill from the Department of Justice representing the federal defendants. We believe there are a number of grounds in which the court can affirm the judgment below, but probably the most straightforward grounds would be to hold, first, that the challenge to the 2009 inauguration is moot, as plaintiffs have now conceded, and second, that any challenge to future inaugurations is too speculative to support Article III standing.
How's it less speculative, or how's it Lee versus Weissman affect what you're talking about in terms of speculative? Because there, the middle school graduation had already occurred. The high school graduation was still to come 4 years later. And yet the court said, we assume the clergy's participation in any high school graduation would be about what it was at Deborah's middle school ceremony. And then said we can with confidence describe customary features of high school graduations. And then said it's likely, if not certain, that the invocation and benediction would occur 4 years hence at our high school graduation. All that seems right on point here in terms of the imminence.
Well, two things. If I read the opinion correctly, the school district there actually conceded that the challenged religious practices would occur in the future. And here we have a very different situation. Although certainly these kinds of practices have occurred in the past, whether they occur in the future is entirely dependent on the decision of a single individual, the president-elect of the United States, in those future elections. And neither you nor I nor anyone knows who that individual will be. So our position is that it would be irresponsible for us or for the
you
court.
You had a different principal of the school in Lee versus Weissman who decided not to have this kind of ceremony.
Well, yeah, I think the school district as a party conceded that those religious exercises would occur in the future, and that was sufficient for the court to be able to find a scenario that's far different from what's involved here. Here we, none of us has any idea what's going to happen in 2013 or 2017. Again, just completely depends on what the president will select.
Overwhelmingly likely that the president-elect in 2013 will say, so help me God.
I don't deny that this has certainly happened consistently in the past. But again, one analogy would be we've never had a woman who to be president. But that doesn't mean we won't have one in 2013
or 4 years ago. It was overwhelmingly unlikely we would have an African-American president.
Exactly. And I think we're in the same scenario. We just don't know what's going to happen. And since we don't know what's going to happen,
and I think what we need to be certain. Four of our presidents have not lived out their first terms.
Your count is probably better than mine, but certainly.
Do we have to be certain, or just is it? I thought it was likelihood.
Well, the term is demonstrable probability, I believe, from the cases. So here.
I thought it was a reasonable expectation.
That's another way it's expressed. There are various terms
so
that are used.
There's uncertainty, but surely there's a reasonable expectation, isn't there, that the next president will follow suit?
Well, I think there's not a demonstrated probability. And to the term, you have to read those terms together to mean something, and I think that this just doesn't pass.
So what would suffice? The president-elect there's an election, we have a president-elect, and he announces his plans?
Right.
Is it anything short of that?
I don't think so.
Suppose the president-elect is a clergyman. Or married a candidate is a clergyman, and a leading candidate.
I think in terms of imminence, another important point is that
so Mr. Nudo, what's his name? Governor Huckabee, for instance.
Mr. Nudo brought this a very similar suit in 2004 with respect to that inauguration. And he was able to litigate his request for a preliminary injunction before the district court. He appealed that to this court. And he appealed that all the way through the United States Supreme Court before the inauguration occurred. So there's nothing that would suggest he can't do the same thing.
The mere fact that he can do it later doesn't mean he can't do it now.
Well, I think it relates to the imminence point. And in McConnell versus FEC, for example, that's the primary case on which we rely. The Supreme Court held that a situation in which plaintiffs were challenging election rules that barred certain advertisements within 45 days of a primary election. And the Supreme Court held that a challenge to that statute was not imminent enough to support standing because the particular senator who was involved had 5 more years of his term. And it was clear to the court that that kind of a challenge could be brought successfully within that 45-day period. And I think the plaintiffs have come up with no argument that I'm aware of why the McConnell principle in a case shouldn't be controlling here. We're 3-plus years away from the next inauguration, and we have a scenario where we know that Nudow himself litigated his request for a preliminary injunction in a similar context all the way through the United States Supreme Court. He was denied at every level, but again, he was able to vindicate his rights at each level unsuccessfully. So again, I think the simplest way to resolve the case is to say that the 2009 claims are moot and the 2013 and 17 claims are not imminent enough and too speculative. But if you go beyond that,
why doesn't the scenario you just recounted relate not to imminence, but rather to whether this matter would escape review?
I think it relates to both, and probably
if it doesn't escape review because of because of the time required to litigate it, then perhaps Mr. Nudow improvidently conceded that the 2009 case is moot.
Well, I think it does. It does not escape review for the reasons this court gave in the the Armstrong decision. In that case, the court held that in a situation where the plaintiff fails to protect his rights by seeking a stay from the district court or the court of appeals or any available judicial body, then they forfeit their right to argue that the case would evade review if it wasn't allowed to go on. And the court cited favorably a case from the Eighth Circuit called Tanager. And Tanager specifically said that if a party doesn't appeal the denial of a preliminary injunction or a stay, if it fails to do so, then they forfeit their right. And that's what happened here. They had a chance. The district court's order denying their request for a preliminary injunction was entered on January 16th. If course, the inauguration doesn't occur until the 20th. So they had 4 or 5 days, depending on how you count it, to seek emergency relief from this court and from the Supreme Court. And they certainly should have been ready, I would think, to come right to the courthouse as soon as they were denied relief. So there's no question that the court couldn't have ruled on a motion like that. So again, I think it's clear under the Armstrong and Tanager cases that they can't argue that the case evades review because of their own failure to argue it.
Back to imminence, nonetheless, it's your position that the matter won't be imminent until there's another president-elect?
I think, yes, that's right.
Who does what? Who announces his intentions?
Right.
So if he doesn't say anything, the case never becomes sufficiently ripe?
That's possible. But I think that's unlikely because in the past, if past practice shows you anything, it's that these sorts of things are announced in enough time that...
Are the contents of the inaugural prayers announced ahead of time?
No, but the fact that...
Okay, and that's going to... Obviously, the content of the prayer could really affect the analysis.
Well, the plaintiffs here are not bringing any separate challenge that relates to the content of the prayers that were given. They don't like the fact that any prayers were given by anybody, and particularly mad that the prayers were given by clergy. But they haven't really focused on the content of anything that was said here to bring sort of a separate claim about that.
Basically a Christian or Judeo-Christian invocation, right? I mean, if it were a prayer to Gaia, perhaps they wouldn't care.
You could ask Mr. Newdow that, but my sense is they don't want any prayer to any god.
Well, Gaia would perhaps avoid that problem.
But it might. Two final...
That would be a post-Kyoto prayer.
I'll take your word for that. With respect to redressability, again, I think the key fact is the plaintiffs conceded at page 14 of their reply brief that it's the president-elect and the president-elect only who controls the content of the inaugural ceremony. So, and they, of course, have not sued the president on the notion they have that he has free exercise rights, but I think they've taken that issue right out of the case by conceding that it's only the president who makes these decisions. Plus, if you look at the record shows that, for example, the JCCIC, it didn't have any control over the content of what was said. It didn't have any authority to somehow countermand the president's order.
Is it clear that it doesn't exist anymore?
That's correct.
And the PIC doesn't exist anymore?
You can't. The PIC's webpage isn't even up anymore, but they don't
exist. Well,
it's
clear that no one exists if they don't have a webpage. More or less true commercially, anyway.
Well, that wasn't a very good point. No, they don't exist. And even Chief Justice Roberts, there's a declaration in the record from Mr. Menier that explains clearly that Chief Justice Roberts only recited the oath himself in response to the information that the president...
He does exist without a web page, right?
I think that's still correct. And finally, with the merits, with respect to the merits...
How about standing? Can we... you passed over that. Why wouldn't the plaintiffs have standing here, given the raft of cases that the Supreme Court has decided over the years, which seem similarly situated with someone hearing or a prayer or observing a display?
I think we start with Valley Forge, where the Supreme Court said that sort of generalized abstract injuries are not sufficient to state to support standing under the Establishment Clause, and then made the point about the fact that the plaintiffs only learned about the issue they were complaining about through a news release. And
the conduct, but certainly Lynch and Van Orden and Allegheny County and Marshfield Chambers and others, it seems highly unlikely that the Supreme Court just for decades has missed this dispositive standing issue that otherwise would have avoided hundreds of pages in the U.S. reports and difficult cases.
Again, I think what makes this case different is the way the plaintiffs alleged they were exposed to the inauguration. They watched it on TV or on some other form of mass media.
So if in a classroom a prayer comes in over the internet, the school decides to show the prayer being given by someone over the internet, that's good?
No, I think that's a different case. What makes this case special is that this was projected by the mass media to the entire country. anybody in the entire United States could have picked this up on TV or on the internet or on the radio and listened to it. And this case, we think, just comes too close to authorizing anybody
to vindicate an interest in the law. How about if he personally attends?
I think that's a closer case.
Okay. And then I had interrupted you on the merits, I guess.
We think you could, as an alternative ground for affirmance, just affirm because the plaintiffs have such an insubstantial case on the merits that it's a very easy question. The question of the inaugural prayer was decided essentially by the Marsh decision, which upheld, which rejected challenges to the practice of legislative prayer based on the history of the First Amendment, which showed that these kinds of things were going on at the very same time the First Congress adopted the Establishment Clause. And the Supreme Court also has specifically, as you mentioned, Judge Kavanaugh, even in its most latest, one of its latest decisions, Van Orden, continue to approve of these sorts of ceremonial references to God and religion, as in "So help me God," or these prayers. So I think based
on that, the references were to Jesus rather than to God. Would that be a different case?
It could be. Justice O'Connor, in her Elk Grove opinion, made the point that the term God at this point has some religious content, but not so much that it raises Establishment Clause concerns when used in a ceremonial context like this. So I think that would be a different case, and her rationale might not apply to references like that or specific references.
Can we go back to standing for a moment?
Sure.
Because it seems to me that Valley Forge, one thing that's happening there is that it's something sort of discreet that's happening, and the court is saying, well, you guys are several states away, and so why is that your problem? But an inauguration is a national event. I mean, that's the whole point of it. So why wouldn't we look at that differently? In other words, what's curious to me is we seem to be trying to make a distinction between if you had a seat, if you were on the mall looking at it on a screen, if you were looking at it at home on your television. Why should we make that distinction when it's a national event?
I think, again, because the court has made clear that standing shouldn't be so manipulable that anybody can just come in and vindicate an interest in having the law applied correctly by just alleging a very abstract and not substantial standing injury effect. And that's, I think, what this case is, again, because under the plaintiffs, their position is basically, if you see this in any way, TV, radio, you don't have to be there, you can bring a suit. Well, that just would allow anybody in the entire United States to bring a claim. And that's a little too
broad. Well, but not everyone, and I think the plaintiffs respond to this, not everyone in the United States shares the same religious beliefs. And so certain people are going to be fine with what happens, and other people are going to take offense at what happens. It's not that everyone in the United States is going to bring suit. I think Justice Scalia talked about this, that the fact that a lot of people are injured doesn't defeat standing. It's the question of whether there's a differentiated injury among
people. Well, that's right, but I think
people.
If you're...
And so different people react differently and have different beliefs, and thus will have differentiated injuries, which seems to satisfy what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, I think, again, if you think about this in a different context, let's say it's not a religion case but an environment case. The fact that you could have everybody watching TV and you have an environmental group like Sierra Club, they watch TV and they're aggrieved by something they see because of their beliefs, that wouldn't be enough to give them standing.
But if you go see it is enough, under Lujan?
If you're there in person and if it's a regular part of your activities, and then, right.
Further questions?
Just one question on the redressability. What's your response to Mr. Newdow's point that even though the court can't act directly against the president, it's enough for the sake of redressability to say that the president will probably do the right thing?
Well, again, two critical points here. First, in the distinction between this case and Franklin. In Franklin, the Supreme Court held that the court could enter an injunction against the Secretary of Commerce. But in that case, the Secretary of Commerce had authority over the subject matter of the suit. The Secretary of Commerce had the authority to decide whether or not to count federal employees who were living overseas. That's part of his job in running the census. Here, what you have are defendants who are not responsible for the content of the inauguration as a part of their duties. The AFIC provides loans of military material. It provides color guards and bands. It's not going to tell these reverends that they can't give a prayer when the president has told them they can. It doesn't have that authority. Neither does the JCIC. And we know from Chief Justice Roberts only recited these words because the president had indicated that he was going to do that.
President-elect.
President-elect, thank
you. Not president until he's completed the oath. And he's completed the oath before he says, so help me God.
I think he's probably his president as soon as noon on January 20th. If he doesn't say the oath right, then that can be corrected.
That's correct.
I'm not sure that's been tested yet.
Hopefully never will be.
Yes, hope not.
If the court has no further questions, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon.
May it please the court. Dominic Perella on behalf of the Presidential Inaugural Committee and Emmett Belliveau. Pardon me?
Do you exist?
I do exist, even though I don't have a website, Your Honor.
I thought you went out of business.
Do I personally exist?
No,
I do. The PIC, no. The PIC does not currently have any practical existence.
I thought your charter lasted through 2013.
I'm not certain about that, Judge Brown. I was about to say, as a matter of corporate law, I'm not certain what the expiration of the PIC is, but it has no practical existence after the inauguration. The people who participated in it are now scattered to the four winds.
It may formally exist, however.
It may. I can't represent that it doesn't. Let me turn to the redressability question that was raised by Judge Brown. We would submit that the redressability holding of the district court with respect to the PIC and probably with respect to all of the defendants can be affirmed for a very simple reason, and that's that Mr. Newdow simply failed to carry his pleading burden. Mr. Newdow says in his reply brief that the PIC assists in delivering the clergy speech. He also says that the PIC controls the inaugural platform such that it could bar the clergy from taking the stage. But his complaint mentions nothing about either of these things. There are no allegations of fact to the effect that the PIC assists in delivering clergy speech. There are no allegations suggesting that if the PIC's role were eliminated, the clergy somehow would not take the stage. And there are no allegations of fact suggesting that the PIC controls the stage such that it could bar participants. For that reason, I think that's fatal to Mr. Newdow's case. It's the plaintiff's burden to allege these facts, and he's failed to do so here. We think that you could affirm on that ground alone. I do want to mention one new wrinkle.
As to PIC.
Well, as to the PIC, and I think also, although I would have to leave this to the DOJ lawyer to be certain, but I think also with respect to at least the JCCIC, the AFIC, and other parties named by Mr. Newdow, I don't think the complaint mentions any facts with respect to them either in terms of their connection to the clergy speakers.
Well, maybe I misunderstood, but I think in his presentation, Mr. Newdow acknowledged that at this point we're really focused on the Chief Justice as a source of relief, not these other ephemeral entities.
Judge Ginsburg, I think that's right. He did acknowledge that, and I think that would be an easy way to resolve the case.
Well, it doesn't resolve the case. It just in part.
Agreed. To the extent you need to reach other issues of standing, I think the redressability issue, certainly, as I said, with respect to BIC and some of the other entities, if they exist or as an alternative holding, would do away with the case with respect to them. I want to briefly mention a new wrinkle that Mr. Newdow raises in his reply brief. He says that he did make sufficient allegations as to the PIC because he quoted 36 U.S.C. Section 501, which is the statute in which Congress describes the PIC and says that the PIC is, quote-unquote, in charge of inaugural events. The answer to that is simple. The provision Mr. Newdow cites is simply irrelevant to this case because it does not reach the swearing-in ceremony or other events on the West Capitol. 36 U.S.C. Section 507, which is part of the same chapter, states that the entire statutory chapter, including the description of the PIC's authority, quote, does not apply to the United States Capitol building or grounds, unquote. So you're left with one and only one assertion that could be deemed to be an assertion of fact by Mr. Newdow, and that quote-unquote assertion of fact is legally irrelevant. I would also briefly say that we agree with the DOJ's analysis of Franklin. Franklin is a case where the Secretary of Commerce clearly had a decision to make. The Secretary's decision was essentially the controlling decision there. The Secretary decided how to allocate overseas federal employees for census purposes. The court said in that case, given that the Secretary is making the primary decision and the President is essentially deciding whether or not to rubber stamp it, they can assume that the President would follow suit and go ahead and transmit the Secretary's findings to the Congress. If you were to take that holding and apply it to a case where it's unclear what decisions, if any, the named defendants make, you would more or less eliminate redressability in a multi-defendant case.
That's a little extreme.
Well, Your Honor, anytime you take a multi-defendant case where for some reason you can't name the defendant that's primarily responsible for the decision-making, mm-hmm. If you can name any other defendant who has any tangential relationship to it without specifying their role, even if they have no decision-making process, you have what's essentially a declaration against an unnamed defendant that they're presumed to follow.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perella. Mr. Newdow, with help from us, used all your time. But we'll give you time for rebuttal, but not for repetition.
Okay.
A rebuttal of what we've heard since you spoke.
Okay. May I just...
Well, why don't you start with 5 minutes, and we'll hope we can do with that.
Thank you. First of all, in regard to what was just stated, there was a letter I sent in response to their letter. If you continue on reading on Section 507, it specifically states that you can, in fact, that what was just stated is that the capital grounds is not included. It's only not included if the Congress doesn't give permission. And they're in cahoots here with the Joint Congressional Commission on Inaugural Ceremonies. As soon as the Joint Commission says you have access to this, then in fact they do have control over the capital grounds and the inaugural dais. And
it's in the Congressional Commission, we're told, no longer exists either.
Correct, but during the time of the inauguration. Also, in regard to what I had said earlier, I guess I didn't make it clear in terms of the 2009 inauguration being moot. It still falls under the capable of repetition and evading review exception. So if I wasn't clear on that, we still adhere to the idea that it is capable of repetition and evading review. In that regard, the ability that Mr. Sturgill mentioned about going to the Supreme Court, et cetera, within 4 days, that was for the preliminary injunction, which has a whole set of separate requirements. That's not just for the general merits argument that we were making.
Are you responding to his mention of Armstrong?
Yes, I think so, okay, with regard to the fact that we could just get there and that it's not doesn't fall under the capable of repetition and evading review exception. The being not responsible, again, what Mr. Sturgill said, that the Presidential Inaugural Committee is not, maybe it was Mr. Perella, who just said that the Presidential Inaugural Committee is not responsible for this. They are, again, on 36501, they are the people in charge. To suggest that the people in charge are not responsible seems to me a somewhat frivolous argument. Yes, all we ever said, all we ever conceded was that ultimately it's the President who makes all the decisions, but they still exercise the acts, and it's the acts that are being challenged, just like any other time when the President says to any other underling, I want you to do this. It's always the President who has the ultimate authority, but we still have the ability through the courts to seek redress, which is, again, what Justice Scalia specifically stated in his concurrence in Franklin v. Massachusetts. In terms of the Valley Forge issue and this general vague, you know, that this is just everybody would have standing, as you mentioned, Judge Kavanaugh, we have scrap, you know, the fact that many people share the same injury doesn't mean that there's no problem. Justice Kennedy had the same thing in his concurrence in Lujan. He said the fact that there are a number of people who have the same injury doesn't make any difference. If one individual is injured in a particularized, concrete, personalized manner, you know, it doesn't matter. Everybody can have that same injury. You still have standing. And the way I was...
The injury would run, I guess, to all atheists who, by your account, are stigmatized.
In this, yes, I think that's what we would say. I like to picture it in terms of like packets of monotheism being, you know, maybe the Armed Forces Inaugural Committee gets a gun and they're shooting out these packets of monotheism. Some people, you know, doesn't hurt. Some people actually enjoy it. And some people go, ouch, that really hurts. All right, this is a concrete injury. And if it comes through the TV or wherever it comes, you're still getting hit. It's sent out with the intention of hitting all those people, and it's hitting them, and it hurts. So I think they all have that concrete injury. And I think there's no question by Lujan that standing exists. And again, by using the Allen v. Wright, look at all the other cases that standing exists. And we're here again for standing. In terms of the mention of ceremonial deism with Justice O'Connor and God, that was Justice O'Connor. I don't think anybody agreed, joined her in her opinions. We also have Justice Thomas, Justice Souter, and Justice Scalia, who have at various times stated, look, when you talk about God, that's religion. It's talk about God.
And Van Orden, the plurality in Van Orden also seemed to back away from the idea that references to God were not religious. Significant.
Correct. And plus, even if they said that, they have also said repeatedly, Justice Scalia said, repeatedly in many different contexts, we have warned that it is not courts who make these decisions. Right? You can't tell us this case after case where, you know, it's the individual who determines whether or not something is religious to them. And I think we're entitled to assume that when you're talking about God, we find that religious. I think if we talk to the clergy, they certainly would find it religious. You know, and if you're not talking to them, and I granted that we can't make the argument, but certainly it's using the Lord's name in vain. That was the argument made in Elk Grove in one of the briefs.
Well, it's certainly religious. I agree with you on that. But it's also, as I mentioned when you were up here before, something that's woven into a lot of different facets of American history. And the court has used history as a guide in this area. And I don't know how we can avoid all those precedents that are out there with respect to, and some of it's in dicta, I take your point on that, but the In God We Trust and So Help Me God and the Legislative Chaplain and Legislative Prayer, and the list goes on, as you're well aware.
The list goes on, but A, they are dicta. They've never been brought to the fore. The same argument was used in Bible reading in Engel. Justice Douglas used it in his concurrence. He said, well, you know, these are things we do. That was one of them. And then the next year, the Supreme Court overturned it. The issue is whether or not it is, at least to my mind, whether or not it is directly subversive of the principle of equality. And clearly this is. And when the Supreme Court gets a chance to address it, as they did in Loving v. Virginia, as they do in all these cases, when they look at the issues and they say, wait a second, you know, yeah, we've come up with this excuse for quite some time. It's time to end that excuse. This is directly
the
subversive.
The best analogies here are probably Marsh v. Chambers, right?
In terms of?
The precedent that we have to look to for something like this.
I would,
with a legislative chaplain in prayer that opens the legislative day, the inaugural essentially opens the executive term. And so in that sense, that's the best analogy we have probably in terms of precedent. Maybe you disagree and tell me why that's wrong.
I would disagree. First of all, the, you know, Doe v. Tyingapahoa Parish School District, they made that thing. They said the legislative deliberative body exception. Right, that was an exception. I would also look to Lee versus Weissman. I'm not sure why you wouldn't go there when Lee.
Well, I think that's pretty carefully cabined to the school's context. That doesn't mean the principle can't apply elsewhere. I take your point on that, but it certainly is a school's focused case.
I would grant that, but again, if we look through what they said, you know, that this is something where it's. First of all, there are children here, and we have children. We have 40 children among our plaintiffs. And second of all, so I would make the distinction between children as opposed to schools. And second of all, I think the issue was, you know, Marsh v. Chambers. First of all, Marsh v. Chambers may well be overruled. Nobody has standing to bring that case except legislators, and every legislator knows if he brings that case, he won't be a legislator much longer. So we have the Santa Fe Independent School District where the Supreme Court specifically stated the religious liberty protected by the Constitution is abridged when the state affirmatively sponsors the particular religious practice of prayer. That's exactly what goes on here. So, and that
was another school's case, though.
That was another school's case, but it wasn't, that sentence certainly wasn't limited to the schools, and the idea is that the state is not allowed to sponsor prayer. So I think that in regard to your original question, we have this circular argument. That, you know, they say, well, we can have legislative prayer. All right. Well, then we can have God We Trust on the coins because we have legislative prayer. Oh, and then we can have this because we have In God We Trust. And we keep working our way around, and nobody ever says, well, wait a second, let's look at the basic principle. And the fact, if we look at all the principal dicta from the United States Supreme Court, every single one of those.
I think the issue is that on most of the things you've discussed, and this is Justice Breyer's point in Van Orden, most of the things you've discussed have been around since the founding of the country in some form or another. And so when the analogy breaks down, for example, some of the displays that have been challenged successfully, that hasn't necessarily been around since the founding of the country. But for those things that have, the court has set those off and said, essentially, those are permissible.
I would challenge that. Those things have, you know, first of all, we have the Pledge of Allegiance, for instance. That was 1954. The In God We Trust wasn't officially until the 1950s. It was first in 1864. That's almost 100 years after the beginning. Even God Save the United States in this Honorable Court, which I won't go into. But that, or the best we know, is from, you know, 1820s or something. We don't even know when that started. So the only one we have is...
So Help Me God's from 1789. In the oath for judicial officers.
For judicial officers, yes, but not for...
I know it's disputed as presidents, but at least we know that that oath was...
Correct, and maybe, you know, for some odd reason, you know, they decided that judicial officers, their oath is certainly not a national ceremony. We don't generally watch when that occurs, and that may be the distinction. Nobody knows. Plus, you know, we have to look at the context, too. When this happened in those years, you know, nobody knew a lot of stuff that we know. John Adams' daughter gets breast cancer. So, you know, they attribute it to God because there was nothing. Nobody knew about germs. Nobody knew about a lot of the things we have answers to now. So essentially everybody believed in God back then.
There was a lot of discussion, and maybe this is getting astray, but a lot of discussion of these issues at the time. There were people who objected to religious references at the time the country was founded.
And the founders, in fact, abided by what those people did. I mean, the very first act of Congress, the first act of the government of the United States is the Oath Act, which entailed the removal of two references to God. The original oath of office that was taken by the Congress before we had the Oath Act said, in the presence of Almighty God, so help me God. They removed both of those references. I think that is extremely probative. You know, why would you take it out if you thought there was no problem with it? So the fact
that they were putting it into the oath for judges,
at times certain things.
What they were thinking?
I don't know what they were thinking either. Which allows us to now say, let's use some principles like the principle of neutrality.
Maybe they would like judges who believe in God, not legislators.
And that seems to be the problem. So, and that is the problem. I mean, we can't get an atheist to hold these positions in power, and that, which goes again to Van Orden, you know, Justice Breyer with his saying, well, you know, we don't want to make a problem now. It's been in place for quite some time. Well, it got in place because atheists were so politically disenfranchised. They couldn't possibly object at that time. If you objected in the 1950s, you lost your job. You were a communist. You had all these horrible things about you. You know, that's the whole point, and I was quite disappointed, and others were, that, you know, Justice Breyer, that was his argument. I think what we're supposed to be doing is standing up for the little guy, and unfortunately, we are the little guys right now. So I would, but that again is a merits question. In terms of standing, I still think we have the standing issue.
Thank you, Mr. Newdow.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Perella, Mr. Virgil, thank you all.